Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're going to finish this chapter with text 22 and 23. And we'll chant together text 22. Everything all right? Okay. Bhumir Bharavataranaya Yudyushma Janma. Jata Karishyati Sarair Apidush Karani. Vādhār vimoha yaki yagya krito tadarhan. Shudran kalaukshati pujo yat nyahanishyad ante. Homer bharavataranaya yudhushva janma. Jata karishyati sarair api dushkarani. Vadair vimoha yati yagya krito tadarhan. Shudran kalaukshati bujo nyahanishad ante. Ladies, please. Omehe of the earth. Bhara, the burden. Avataranaya, to diminish. Yudushu, in the Yadu dynasty. Ajanma, the unborn Lord. Jataha, taking birth. Karishyati, he will perform. Surai, by the demigods. Api, even. Dushkarani, difficult deeds. Vadai, by speculative arguments. Bimohayati, he will bewilder. Yajna Kritaha, the performers of Vedic sacrifices. Atat Arhan, who are unfit to be so engaged. Shudran, the low-class men. Halau, in the degraded age of Kali. Chiti Gojaha, rulers. Nyahanishyat, he will kill. Ante, at the end. Translation, to diminish the burden of the earth, the unborn Lord will take birth in the Yadu dynasty and perform feats impossible for even the demigods. Propounding speculative philosophy, the Lord as Buddha will bewilder the unworthy performers of Vedic sacrifices, and as Kalki, the Lord will kill all the low-class men posing as rulers at the end of the age of Kali. And the purport? It is understood that in this verse, the description of the Lord's appearance in the Yadu dynasty refers to the appearance of both Krishna and Balaram, who together removed the demoniac rulers who were burdening the earth. Srila Jiva Goswami has pointed out that the description of the incarnations to deal with Shudran, or low-class men, refers to both Buddha and Kalki, those who misuse Vedic sacrifice to engage in gross sense gratification, such as the sinful killing of animals, are certainly in the category of Shudra, as are the so-called political leaders of Kali Yuga, who perform many atrocities in the name of state management. And the final verse of the chapter. O mighty armed king, there are innumerable appearances and activities of the Supreme Lord of the universe, similar to those I have already mentioned. In fact, the glories of the Supreme Lord are unlimited. Thus ends the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 11th canto, 4th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Drumila Explains the Incarnations of Godhead to King Nimmi. Similar to the lists in Canto 1, Chapter 3, and Canto 2, here's another listing. As happens in the Itihasas and Puranas, repetition, sometimes in a synopsis form, sometimes in a more medium expanded, sometimes in a more expanded form. Messages are repeated. And when that repetition takes place, it's not at all unstimulating. It's something that's the simple phrases that are spoken of in reciting the forms of the Lord that appear, they stimulate feelings towards that particular incarnation of the Lord, especially one who has become a little familiar with the various incarnations of the Lord. And, the concluding message, Bhurini Bhuri Yashaha, Yasha Saha, the glories of the Lord are innumerable. The glorious qualities of the Lord are innumerable. The glorious pastimes of the Lord are innumerable. And these sound vibrations, these messages, serve to stimulate ecstatic love. Even just hearing the short little phrase, which to speak of the more elaborate, detailed expansion of. It was like just yesterday, there was a very brief description of Lord Ram. Just mentioned. At the same time, in the ninth canto, there's medium description. Again, listing and listing and listing, not so much elaborating. Some philosophical presentation, but summarizing the pastimes in a shortened form. And then there's the Ramayana, the more expanded form. And in the realm of the demigods, the forms of all of these narrations are far, far more expanded. So the glories can go on. And they serve the purpose of stimulating our appreciation for the personality of Godhead and his glories. Bhurini Bhuri Yashaha. In the verse that we chanted together, there's three that are mentioned, Krishna and Balaram, and then Buddha, and then Kalki. Similar to the list in the first canto, if they include that list. Now the conclusion of the list in the third canto, canto 1, chapter 3, is that Krishna is the source of all incarnations. That particular verse has been accepted by Jiva Goswami. In fact, elaborately, he insists, puts forward the argument that this is the Mahavakya, Paribhas Sutra of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. It governs the whole message of everything, all the other 17,999 verses. Has a very special role in Srimad Bhagavatam. So, Krishna is the source. It says it very simply in Bhagavad Gita, the first of the Chatur Sloki verses, that he's the source of everything. And everything comes from him. So all these incarnations, they're Krishna's incarnations. And at the same time, he's listed amongst the incarnations of, specifically in chapter 3, it's incarnations of Vishnu. That's not a problem. For some people, it's a problem. For followers of the Srimad Bhagavatam, under the guidance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his disciplic succession, not a problem. Krishna can appear however he likes. It doesn't mean that because he appears this way or that way, he's not the source. This is discussed in Chaitanya Charitamrita very nicely. But Krishna's not a problem. Just like, here's a very simple example. There's primarily six sets of doors, and each one of us that's in the temple room came through one of those doors. So we can say, I came through this door. But that doesn't mean that door is the source of me. I existed before I came through the door. And incarnation, similarly, exist before they appear in this world. They exist in the spiritual world, and they return to the spiritual world. There's the place of Ayodhya, for example, where Lord Ramachandra makes his appearance. And then, after some thousands of years, he returns to Ayodhya with all of his associates. So this is the counterpart, or it's the non-different from Ayodhya. But it's not that Ramachandra didn't exist before he appeared as an incarnation of Vishnu, because the Purusha avatars are specific. It's part of the answer. Could you describe forms of the Lord that appear in this world? And first in the list is the Purusha avatars, because they're forms of the Lord that appear in this world. And through those Purusha avatars, the various categories of incarnations appear in this world. That doesn't mean they didn't exist before they appeared as incarnations of Vishnu. I think that's pretty clear. They have their place in the spiritual world, so they appeared this way. Then, in that transcendental realm beyond this world, of all those expansions that then appear in this world, Krishna is the source of them all. Sarvasya Prabhava. Everything comes from Krishna. He's the Ashraya. So that particular point isn't mentioned here in this listing, but it's an essential understanding from this topmost of all authorities, Srimad Bhagavatam. The three references, the without saying Krishna's name, Krishna is being referred to as he who performed activities that even the demigods couldn't perform. Dushkarani, Suraya api Dushkarani. Suraya is the demigods, and Dushkarani is difficult activities. They couldn't deal with the demoniac kings. So Mother Earth approached them. They approached Lord Vishnu, and Lord Vishnu descended to perform activities even the demigods found to be too difficult. And it's similar to the reference made earlier, that when battles between the demigods and the demons take place, the Lord takes advantage of that to eliminate the demons. That's one of the things that he does. He protects the devotees from the influence of asuric tendency and persons that carry them. Then mentioned is Buddha, and specifically the Sanskrit of the verse is Vadair Vimohayati Yagrakrito Tadarhan. So Vadair is the root is Vada, or the doctrine, or he gave teachings, Buddha gave teachings that are Vimohayati. They bewilder Yagrakrita, the performers of Vedic sacrifice. Atat, they're unfit to perform those Vedic sacrifices. So, you know the history. As a young prince, he saw suffering, and he understood the root of that suffering. I've learned a lot because I visit China. I've had to learn about Buddhism because whether they really know what Buddhism is or not. Largely, they don't. But people say they're, you know, they know about Buddhism or they're Buddhist or something or other. So I felt it was really important. Unlike before I went to visit China, what's Buddhism about? What's its message? And the life of Buddha and so on. Oh, he was from India, or appeared in India. And then his teachings went to China. Compliments of Shankaracharya. So, he saw this and that and the other thing and understood that the root of all suffering is desire. And so, by negative argument, the logic was get rid of desire and you won't have any more suffering. I'm pausing because that's not possible. Prabhupada makes that very clear. Desire is not the problem. It's where you direct the desire. And the Vaishnava solution is direct the desire to the desire of the Supreme. Very simple. Direct desire to fulfill the happiness of the Supreme, enter into that state of love. And that's the condition of oneness between lover and beloved. But Buddha rejected the Vedas and then gave this Vimohayati, he gave this doctrine that was intended to bewilder the unqualified performers of Vedic Yajna and the people that follow them. And Buddha was very powerful. This I've learned, again, I'm going to share something. It's nice visiting a lodge where I can say things that I might have to think about whether I would discuss it at some other temple, because a lodge where you like details and technical things. So I'm going to share some of that. Other people wonder what's going on, but you're going to start asking me questions about stuff instead of saying what's going on. That's a lecture. It's a compliment, it's not a... There's a scholarly bunch here. So, what I've learned from about Buddhism, aside from my own study, just from Tathasandarbha's discussion, you might be interested to know. Those of you who would like to learn more about Buddhism and what they say and why it's not okay, read Tathasandarbha, the Pramaya Khanda section, because Jiva Goswami brings it up four times. And each time, it's, you know, incrementally knocking it over. And, you know, but not just primarily through scripture, but also through very sound logic, or the combination of scripture and sound logic is, and again, and then again, and then again. So what I've learned is not only they say Buddha's teaching presents that the root of all suffering is desire, so just get rid of desire. Jiva Goswami says the root of desire is ignorance. And the essence of that ignorance is ignoring Krishna. So that's the problem. You can't just get rid of desire. But they get rid of desire by saying, well, they don't exactly say that there's no soul, but in essence they're saying that there's no soul because soul has desire. In the purified state, the desire is in the form of prema. So they don't exactly say there's no soul, but get rid of desire means get rid of the soul. It's inferred. Not only they say that, but they say the soul, listen carefully, it's little, you know, it's an electric topic. The soul is both conscious and consciousness. Have you all heard that from Prabhupada's teachings? I heard that so many times. I couldn't exactly understand it, but I just kept repeating it. I didn't really understand it just from repeating it, but I understood it from Jiva Goswami. So he gives the example. He states this, you know, soul is both conscious and consciousness. He gives, follows his method, gives Srimad Bhagavatam references, and then explains it from other commentary. The example is used to help understand of a lamp. So you have a lamp or a candle, and the lamp is luminous, and it illuminates things, including itself, but other things in the room or wherever. As the lamp is both luminous and gives light to other things, the soul is also conscious, and it's a very important concept, and consciousness is extended, certainly through the body, and then through the senses of the body to things outside the body, out there in the material energy, sounds and smells and form and taste and touch, out there. Consciousness extends, and then it goes back through the senses to the mind, then ultimately to the soul. It explains all this. So here's what Buddhists say. No. You can't have a conscious being that's eternal. Now, Jiva Goswami is addressing, according to Gopi Pranadana's presentation, there's apparently, even it was after Buddha was driven out by Shankaracharya, there was some prevalent Buddhist at the time, and the particular prevalent one at the time was Shanik Vijnana Bodies. Body means doctrine again. And Vijnana means, you know, realization. And Kshanik, spelled with a K, means temporary. So their idea goes like this. What are you talking about? Eternal, conscious being. Isn't it a fact that consciousness is only in the moment? Anybody that's been around Buddhism knows that phrase. Be in the moment. Or impersonalism says the same thing during our college days. Be here now. Some heads are nodding. Be in the moment. Because anything else isn't real. It is only the moment. So their classic argument is, listen carefully, how can you pose that there's a eternal conscious being, because we know that consciousness is only moment to moment. For example, we see something blue. And then the next moment, you don't see something blue, you see something yellow, and the blue consciousness is gone, now it's yellow consciousness. And so on. So all it is the moment. So how do you get away with saying there's this eternal conscious being, the soul? They're not exactly saying our philosophy is there's no soul, but they're saying there's no soul by that method. So again, Jiva Goswami brings this up four times and then goes a little distance with it, and then goes a little further with it, and then goes a little further with it, and then goes a little further with it. To establish there is, according to Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, of course, there is a soul that's both conscious and consciousness. And I'm going to go through with you, because this is a Lachwa. He gives four arguments in Tattva Sandarbha. I'll just summarize them. I'll try to summarize them. The refinement of how he makes the presentation, I can't do in the time, but the principles are, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, there is that which is eternal, and there is something that's temporary. And the soul is in the category Sankhya. The soul is in the category of eternal. And matter and its varied forms is temporary. Matter is not temporary, but the configuration of matter is temporary. And the nature of the soul or consciousness is it's unchanging. And, you know, examples and scriptural quotes and from the Upanishads and so forth. There is a conscious, eternally existing soul. And then he explains part of the same first example is consciousness extends out, the information comes back. So the place from which consciousness goes out and the information comes back is unchanging. And the configuration of what's out there, the world of duality, is ever changing. So there are these distinctions. Pretty clear. Then the next argument is there's that which is seen and there's the seer. Now, I didn't know this before I had Tathasandarbha, but it makes sense. The Buddhists say there's no such thing as knowledge and the object of knowledge and the process of knowing. And it goes back to this consciousness is momentary. So all there is the moment. Now they don't say what it is that's being conscious, the conscious of the moment, but just all there is the moment and that's all there is. So if you trace it back, and where is it headed? Well, if there's no soul, that's all there is the moment, and you're striving to become desireless, just you reach that state of desirelessness, and what's left? Nothing. Or nirvana. Nothingness. And if you're really going to be a Buddhist, it's not just you have to be vegetarian. You have to really aspire for nothingness. And the reason for nothingness is that's reality, and everything else is suffering. If you don't like suffering, go to this nothingness place, because that's reality. And now in between nothingness and what we think is somethingness, there's this moment to moment. So be in the moment, do your Buddhist practice, and there's different, all kinds of different Buddhist practices according to the divisions of Buddhism these days. But you do that, and the desire flame becomes less and less and less and less. You're in the moment, but those moments extend out to eternity, and then you pass through the eternity bubble and you enter into nothingness. Lovely. There's no happiness there. There's no anything there. It's nothingness. There's no misery there, but there's no happiness there. It's nothingness. So back to this knowledge, the object of knowledge and the process of knowledge doesn't exist, according to Buddhism. So Jiva Goswami takes that to task and says, according to logic and reason, and as well as according to the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam and the Vedas, consciousness allows for the seen and the seer, or the act of perception. So there is a process of knowledge, the knowledge acquiring senses extend, consciousness extends through them, and there are objects, sound, form, touch, taste, smell, that are described in the process of creation. They're withdrawn at the time of annihilation, but they're energies of the Supreme Lord that manifest according to his will. So there's the seer and the seen. It's not totally dissimilar from temporary and eternal, but it's a subtlety. Those are two out of four. Then he brings it up again. He pins him to the mat again, does it a different way. And the different way is very far out. He refers to some verses from Canto 11, chapter 3, where he describes the different state of consciousness, sleep, awake, sleep, and deep sleep. And I'm not going to go through it in detail, but in essence what he says is, even if the Buddhist and the Shankara followers say the subtle body doesn't exist, mind, intelligence, and false ego doesn't exist, therefore, that, you know, consciousness is only in this upadhi area, therefore, all there is Brahman for the Shankara followers, and all there is nothingness for the Buddhists. The Bhagavatam states differently, and it's very simple. During the wake state, the senses are active and the mind is active. That's the awake state of consciousness, according to the Vedic paradigm. So this, the conscious self and consciousness extending in awake state. Then in the sleep state, the gross body is not active, but the subtle body, particularly the mind, and our dear friend, the false ego, is active, because we, in dreaming state, we dream that we're in the dream. That's false ego. It's active. And the mind is there because that's the place where the dream takes place, is in the mind. And then in this third state, according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, even false ego in deep sleep where there's no dreaming, or let's take it really extreme, when you're under anesthesia, that's like really deep sleep, no dreaming, no awake consciousness, they can cut you up and you don't feel anything. The mind is dormant or withdrawn or anesthetized, and the false ego is also dormant or anesthetized. And then he says, and then when you wake up, you say, oh, I slept well. I wasn't disturbed by any bad dreams or anything. Then the argument is, how did you know that? And the answer is, because you experienced it. You can't attest to something that you didn't experience. It's right in the Bhagavatam. If you want to check it out, it's in Tattvasandarbha, the explanation, in classic Jiva Goswami style. A little difficult to understand, like Bhaktisiddhanta's writings are a little difficult to understand. But you take the time with the word, the choice of words, and it's compelling. So he uses, that translation is the witness and the witness, which is very similar to the seer and the seen, but the distinction is specifically on this point, that when you're in deep sleep, where there's no dreaming, you're still aware that you're in deep sleep with no dreaming, although there's no dreaming. Although, so, and false ego and the mind are not active. Because, why? Because the soul is conscious eternally, even in that condition. Supposing you become, in other words, application is, supposing you become a Buddhist, supposing you reach this nirvana state, how do you know that you're there? I've asked Buddhists this question. They don't, it's like a boomerang. They don't know how to, like, even process that one. How do you know that you're enlightened? Or you're in this nirvana state? How do you know it? Jiva Goswami says you know it because you've experienced it, and you can come back out of that deep sleep state into the awake state, and somebody asks you, we have this convention, you know, did you sleep well last night? And you could say, no, I had bad dreams, or I was troubled by some circumstance, or I heard some bad news and I couldn't sleep well, or my mind was disturbed, I couldn't sleep well. But the deep sleep is when that is quieted down, and false ego similarly. Nice? You want to hear the fourth one? Go for it, Laura. Yeah, the fourth is, by nature, the soul has qualities like Krishna. Krishna is Satchitananda Vigraha, the soul is Satchitananda. I'll just add another little thing for, you know, the intellectual audience. One of the approaches that he uses is, from the microcosm, you can understand something about macrocosm, like by testing the drop of water from the ocean, you can understand the makeup of the ocean. Or the gold and the gold ornament tells you about the quality of the gold in the gold mine. And then he goes the other way. The macro, you know something about the macro, then you can tell something about the micro. You know the nature of Krishna is that he's supremely conscious, then you can know something about the soul. The soul is conscious. Because the Vedas say the soul is part and parcel of the Supreme. So now, since we know that the soul is by nature like Krishna, Ananda, then why does the soul experience unhappiness? Well, that's a puzzle. Philosophically, it's a puzzle. How does it happen? How do you get unhappiness when by nature you're happy? So that's another example that he uses, and I'm not going to elaborate, but a distinction between the soul in his covered state of consciousness and the soul is in the uncovered state of consciousness. We're pleasure-seeking beings because it's our natural state. Very logical. And when there's this unhappiness, we want to return to our natural state of happiness. So there's then this, again, this distinction between matter and spirit. It's a Sankhya argument of a certain nature. And so, in fact, the soul is a conscious being. Now, go back to the verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam for this morning. What did Buddha do? Besides throwing out the Vedas, because unqualified Brahmanas were misusing that portion of the Vedas that allows for sacrifice, he bewildered the Mohayati by his vada, his doctrine, his speech of something that's gobbledygook, or just like doesn't make sense, scriptural or common sense, nihilistic. This, and as Prabhupada explains in Bhagavad Gita purport, Dita Raga Bhaya Krodha, this Krodha or anger arises from frustration. And therefore it's very popular. And who likes to be frustrated? We all like to be happy. And I certainly don't want to commit to God. Because, you know, it's not cool. You don't commit to God. I'm rebellious. That's why I'm here. I don't want to submit to God. But I don't like unhappiness. So Buddhism is a really pleasing, popular example. There's no commitment to anybody. Cool. And I get rid of happiness, or get rid of misery. And all I have to say is, you know, nothingness. Vaisheshika Prabhu was sharing this with me. He was visiting not so long ago in New York, distributing books on the street in his dhoti and brought tilak, and somebody came bouncing up to him and said, "Are you enjoying being in the moment?" Or, and so it's popular. Or, I travel in America, with few exceptions around the world, in a dhoti, and certainly in America, it's very common for people to walk up and say, "Excuse me, but are you a Buddhist monk?" And I say, "No, I'm a Krishna monk." They go, "Oh, what's a Krishna monk?" then I get to tell them something about Krishna. Because they know about Buddhism, and it's not like they do lots of Harinam Sankirtan and chant Buddha's name. Just it's popular because there's no commitment to anybody or anything. I was listening to Prabhupada explain his meeting with the CEO of Dynapon. You know, the man that did something that Dynapon never did. They gave him credit without any money up front for printing a Krishna book, and they never do something like that. And Prabhupada was chuckling. The devotees were complimenting Prabhupada for his expertise in dealing with this man, and Prabhupada volunteered. Yes, and when he told me he was a Buddhist, I said, what kind of Buddhist are you? You're not vegetarian. I asked him, are you vegetarian? He said, no. What kind of Buddhist are you? Prabhupada chuckled. You know, we can't do things like Prabhupada did and get away with it. But Prabhupada could do such things, and he did such things. And then the devotee said, yes, Prabhupada, whenever we went back there, he'd always ask, how is Swamiji? He had such affection for you, Prabhupada. So we may not take these details of why the Buddhist be-in-the-moment message is wrong, but it's very helpful to know that it's wrong and why it's wrong. I mean, as devotees, we take that same message and say, like Bhurijan's whole, you know, nine keys of chanting. The first one is one mantra at a time. And he even says it. It's very similar to this Be Here Now message. So you can't chant the next mantra now. You can't worry about the one you didn't chant so nicely a moment ago. Chant, be in the moment. Chant the Maha Mantra present. We don't throw those ideas out, but there's the shelter of them all. The supremely conscious Krishna and the conscious living entity taking shelter of the supremely conscious loving person. It's really nice. The philosophy is very clear, and the process is very joyful, and it's a whole lot better than nothingness or homogenized, you know, somethingness. Call it Brahman, and there's no person, no form, no qualities, no love. Because then you have two, and you can't have two, you got to have one, so it's all that disappears. Philosophized disappears. It's philosophy that similarly doesn't make sense. That's not addressed here. So the next one is Kalki in the list, and both Kalki, this reference to Shudras, both Kalki and Buddha dealt with Shudras. Shudras for the Brahmanas that were unqualified performing these sacrifices. Kshatriyas that were unqualified, like the Kshatriyas of today, that are not leading according to religious principle. So there we are, the end of the chapter on the incarnations of Godhead. Any discussion? Yes.
They must be ruling according to the religious principle.
Yeah.
And the demigod is supposed to be the best example of Krishna's government according to the religious principle. But in Nectar of Devotion, Prabhupada writes that when Lord Krishna was performing many sacrifices, the wives of the demigods were praying for Lord Buddha to appear. And Prabhupada writes that they did not appreciate Krishna's performing so much sacrifice because they are missing their husbands. And they are inviting the Lord Buddha to come. And Prabhupada writes that's why Buddha appeared as the 19th.
Therefore what? Say slower. Prabhupada writes, therefore,
Lord Buddha appeared as the ninth incarnation. So my question is, being the religious principle ruler, best example in the Krishna's government. Why their wife would do such things?
I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like an irreligion.
You got an answer?
Lamented about Lord Guru.
They were what? Lamenting?
They lamented.
Lamented. The wives were lamenting?
Yes. Well, maybe so, right. Maybe right.
But you say the religious principle, according to the religious principle, the ruler is supposed to rule. They are the Kshatriya.
But demigods are supposed to be Kshatriya. So, what is your answer?
To be honest, I don't even understand your question. And furthermore, I don't think I have the answer. Mataji? Yeah.
The easy one first. You know, it's known that sometimes you don't remember all your dreams. So what's happening to the consciousness? Why is it not remembering all the dreams?
Well, it's parked somewhere. It's in your hard drive. And because you can't access that memory in your hard drive doesn't mean there isn't a memory stored in your hard drive. Just like our past lives, we may not remember them, but the impression is there in a subtle form.
In the word-for-word meaning, the avatarinya is translated as diminished. Could you please explain that a little bit?
Avataranaya. Bhara avataranaya. Now, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar. We have somebody in our midst that's more Sanskrit scholarly than me. Now, this is Gopi Pranadana and his team working on the word for word. It's something, this is intuitive, it's not scholarly. It's intuitive that the avatars have a function, and their function is that they diminish such things as burdens. Avataranaya. Aya means unto. Avataranaya. This is a function that they perform. Would you like to comment on that? Look at that. So, here's something that I learned from Jiva Goswami, and it's very interesting. I find it very interesting. There's a rule of Sanskrit that you must take the direct meaning unless the direct meaning doesn't fit, and then you have to take a secondary meaning. He gives us an example, Bhagavad Gita chapter 18, text number 4, I think it is, where Krishna speaks of Arjuna as tiger amongst men. Now you can take the direct meaning as he had claws and he had big teeth and he roared and he gobbled people up like a lion does. That's the direct meaning, tiger amongst men. But it doesn't fit, so you have to take a secondary meaning. Similarly, in his Tathasandarbha, he says, there are these primary realizations of Vyasa and Shukadeva that govern the whole rest of the Bhagavatam. And if there's something that's said later on that doesn't match that, then you have to take a secondary meaning. And he gives examples. The only thing I can understand with this is the direct meaning requires, it doesn't fit, you need a secondary meaning, and then you look at the circumstance. Avataranaya. Ragatmika.
It just occurred to me that why would Buddhists be vegetarian if, you know, there's really no consequence to anything, everything's nothing.
Well, part of his teaching is if you want to get to Buddhahood, you want to get to this nothingness condition, there's a very primary, there's eight, depending upon the brand of Buddhism, but there are things that you must do to get there. And the first of them is compassion. There's no scripture that says dharma. It's Buddha says there's dharma, and the principal dharma is ahimsa. You want to get to nothingness. You've got to be nonviolent and compassionate.
Just another reference for the being in the moment, a Bhaktivinoda Thakur poem, forget the past that sleeps and ne'er the future dream at all, but act in times that are with thee in progress and shut down.
Thank you.
That is
fantastic. Thank you. We have a number of hands. This is in, so what time, do we have a cutoff time or? Huh? Keep going? Keep going. Let's, two from the men's side, two from the ladies' side, and off we go. Sita D. Mooney.
I think this is quick. I don't think I followed, I know I wasn't paying attention carefully, but the Buddhist argument, something about how the soul is not eternal, something about being eternal.
They say there is no such thing as soul. There's no such thing as consciousness that's eternal. All there is the moment. Blue consciousness, yellow consciousness is this kshanic Vigyanavadi group. They're not like pure Buddhists, but it's a certain branch of them. And so they're saying all there is the moment. There's no eternal conscious self that registers this and that and the other thing. All there is the moment.
So I guess the thought that comes to my mind is, it sounds like they're conscious of the moment because they're reacting to it. And if the moment, in a sense, is eternal, then they're conscious.
No. There's no time, nothingness. That's like they're explaining our practice. They're attempting to explain practical experience. Practically, you know, I'm looking out the window and I see the picnic tables and the red roof and, you know, that little place over there. So I'm conscious of that over there. Then I turn attention away from that moment and I'm looking at Sitiddhi Muni and I'm conscious of Sitiddhi Muni. But, you know, that's gone. That moment is gone. Now, what is it that's conscious, that's registering that or this or whatever the next thing is? That's your question, yes? Well, you know, this exists. It seems to exist because there's desire, and you get on the other side of desire, and you realize there's nothing. Not even the moment. Time doesn't exist. Knowledge, the object of knowledge and the process of knowing, is based upon this fault of desire. Just become desireless, and you won't have moments.
Yeah. No, people get... So I guess time is then superior to desire.
So say it again?
Time is
superior
to desire.
You can't have desire without time.
Well, I mean, it sounds here you can't have time without desire because there's no desire, there's no nothing.
The logic works the other way. Excuse me, but you know, this is Baladev.
I mean, their logic.
Okay, on their model?
Yeah, well, according to their
Baladev
logic,
says, yeah. When Vyas saw time because there was conscious perception and this and that and thoughts and things, you have to have time for that. But if you're a Buddhist, if you're a Buddhist, there's no time. There's no consciousness. There's nothing. You think that there is time and you think that there's experience of blueness or yellowness, because of desire. And you have to manage that to get to nothingness. You just stay in the moment. You don't want to get to nothingness. You can just, you know, be involved in misery. A whole string of events that are really nothing, then you're suffering. But get rid of it. You want to get rid of it? You have to get into the moment. And then from the moment you go into the state of nothingness. That's as best as I can understand. You know.
Yeah.
Their program. Their program. So one more from the men's side. Way over here, Janmashtami. Then from the ladies' side, and we're going to end with two more questions after Janmashtami.
Maharaj, I have two questions. I hope it's okay.
Audience is still here. You haven't left yet. That's.
I just was reading in Radha Swami's new book. There was different traditions that believe in the principle of reincarnation, and Buddhists were one.
Oh yeah.
So that's because they haven't achieved nothingness yet.
That's right. You ask a Buddhist. I've done it. What is it that's do you believe? Two questions. Do you believe in reincarnation? Yes. What is it that's reincarnating?
Okay, here's all right. So
he wants to answer it.
I had a discussion with him about this.
Somebody in Canada.
Yeah, his name is Stephen Policastro. He wrote a book.
A book on Buddhism.
Tibetan Buddhism.
Okay, so go ahead.
So he said that I is made of conscious. Doesn't say consciousness, but anyway, whatever his understanding is. He said, I said, so is that conscious being is limited by this body? He said, no. I said, so when body dissolved, the physical body, so I exist. He said, yes. How long? He said, it carries on next body. So I said, for how long? Until the subtleness of mind or false identity will be dissolved. I said, then when the false identity or subtle body dissolved, then what happened to the I? He said, that's also dissolved. Finished. And that is called Bodhisattva. The existence,
okay.
It's confusing, but not
okay.
Need to be explained.
Okay, so that's a gentleman that's scholarly, and I've asked people that aren't scholarly, and they just go, duh. But then even the I that goes from one body to the next, it's nothingness. And you don't realize nothingness until you reach this Bodhisattva state, and then it's nothingness. Interesting. Their goal is like an unending deep sleep. That's the goal. That state of nothingness, the Bodhisattva thing, is like a long sleep where mind, intelligence, and false ego are dissolved. At least appear to be dissolved. They're not active in any case. That's the goal. Just worthy of noting. Second questions?
I've seen in different places in Prabhupada's books this Buddhist understanding of natma. There's no soul. But then you said in the early part of your lecture that it's kind of like no soul, but yet...
Well, you know, there's just like in any teaching, there's different schools. And some say nothing. My understanding, I'm not a Buddhist scholar. This gentleman has a certain school of Buddhism that he's a scholar of. But my understanding is, you know, Gautama Buddha didn't say there's no soul. He didn't speak about soul or no soul. He didn't even address it. He didn't say there's no God. He didn't say there is God. He didn't address it. What he did address was what's spoken. We desire a state of happiness that has no misery. And there's a way to get there. It starts with compassion and nonviolence, ahimsa. And then there's a whole bunch of other, you know, the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, etc., etc. And then you do those things and you do these other things. And my understanding is there's no explicit statement of there is no soul, but afterwards, you know, others may say, just like this gentleman says what he says. And others may say it in a different way. On the lady's side.
Maharaj would mention that how people like Buddhism because there's no commitment, and they can get rid of suffering. My question is...
And they can feel good about themselves because they're being good. They're okay. Being compassionate, they're being nonviolent. I feel good.
Yeah. So how, for a layman, like where you might we meet at the book table and they say we're into... How can we redirect them without not necessarily putting Buddhism down, but how can we gently redirect them to give them some understanding?
This is what I've done, and it's not always effective. But, the same two questions. In, Buddhism is very similar because the tradition, it comes from ancient India. And in Buddhism teaches reincarnation, doesn't it? And they say, yes, of course. And are you clear from your knowledge of Buddhism? What is it that's reincarnating lifetime after lifetime? Are you clear about that? Well, no, really. Well, you might find it interesting because in this Bhagavad Gita, it is specific. What is it that's passing from one life to the next to the next? It's illuminations on that conscious self that's passing on from one life to the next. And, the outcome is different, but there's the ultimate destination of that soul to become free from the bondage of birth and death, samsara. You're familiar with the term samsara, right? Cycle of birth and death. So you might be interested to read this, Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, confronting them. Just inviting them, come on in. Have some prasadam. Yeah, beginning. And if you find some questions that you read that you're not clear about, here's some contact information. We can have some dialogue. Last question over here.
I just have a comment, and I was thinking that another thing that's attractive about Buddhism is that, you can be maybe philosophically believing in God, but psychologically you're an atheist. So there's no competition in Buddhism. You can still be number one. You don't have to submit.
You have to be number two. That's the same. No commitment.
Anyone.
No commitment.
And it's like the whole thing doesn't make sense because out of nothing comes from something comes from nothing. It's like saying like there's a square circle. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Jiva Goswami has some choice words to say about both Shankara's teachings and Buddhism. It's especially is very strong with Shankara's teachings. It's quite unintelligible. And Baladeva Vijayasan in his commentary says no intelligent person would speak this. But if you go anyway, take the time and go through Tattva Sandarbha, that section, and it's a little tough going, I must admit. But the logic is very strong. And, that the holes in the bucket become very clear. Pour water in the bucket and watch what happens. And then do it again and do it again. And the holes in the bucket are very clear. Okay. Thank you all very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.